Yeah, one of the reasons that I've been able to have a lot of fun for about 35 years with this organism is interacting with all sorts of different people, like Herbie, who brought into the questions that I've been posing a lot of rigor and a lot of subtleties that had escaped biologists. And so I thank Herbie as well. And he asked me if I'd introduce the organism to the half of the audience that may not know it. And so the first couple of slides will just sort of give you background on what is this beast that keeps so many of us out of trouble and working and sometimes funded. It is a soil amoeba where each individual cell, you can see them just barely, is about 5 microns across. And they do amazing things. This is what attracts physicists. They make patterns. And they do it reproducibly and in a sort of interesting way. I think this is what brought Herbie in. It looked like a snowflake. And he had worked on snowflakes before. What they're doing is moving into an aggregate and becoming multicellular. So what I'm going to talk about today particularly is how they organize a field of this sort by chemotactic signals and the motility responses that get them to actually move into the aggregate, and to try to convince you that these are coordinated by both the signaling and the response processes being coupled to an oscillator, which I will describe. It's a circuit of various proteins, and that's how you spell dictyostelium. It takes a little practice for most people to say it, so just keep saying it. It's a social amoeba that separated from plants and animals about 1 billion years ago, and this is obviously a dictyostelium point of view of the world, dead center. And it has many advantages as an experimental system, in that the genome is sequenced, so we know all 12,000 genes that it carries, and we can think about what some of them do. There are many well-defined mutant strains, which give you a lot of insight on their natural function by studying the abnormal processes in a null mutant, or what happens if you overexpress it or express it at the different cell type, etc. It grows really well and cheaply, and you can get billions of cells without much trouble, which is very difficult in Drosophila or other things. Yeast, of course, you can do the same things. You can initiate development by removing nutrients. So they stop replicating their genomes. They're not growing. There's no exogenous source of food. And they develop. And you saw sort of the structures they make on that slide I had up for 15 minutes. After 4 hours of development, we'll concentrate on this time here. They signal each other with cyclic AMP. Very close relatives use other chemotactic signals, peptides, terenes. There's nothing particularly special about dictyostelium. It's just about cyclic AMP. It's what dictyostelium uses. And you have to keep in mind that they use it both as an exogenous signal to talk to other cells and an internal signal. And they respond by moving. And that's a lot of what we're talking about today. And the other reasons that bring physicists into this business is that they make dynamic spirals which annihilate and do everything that a BZ reaction does. You can analyze this mathematically and come up with just about exactly what you see. This is a time-lapse movie. This is probably about 1 centimeter. Pardon me?
What are we seeing?
What you're seeing here is that the cells contract when a cyclic AMP wave passes over. They are relaying, as I will get into it, the signal of cyclic AMP such that when a cell responds to cyclic AMP, one of the responses is to produce 10 times more and release it. So they are, you know, not dissipating waves that annihilate, and this can be explained by many of the parameters we know of the receptor, the adenyl cyclase, and other components involved in making cyclic AMP and releasing it. There's no net cell movement in this picture you're seeing. What they're doing is just contracting or expanding, contracting, expanding. A little later on, they'll start moving.
I think the question is, what is actually being visualized?
What you're visualizing is the fact that when they contract, they scatter light differently. This is dark field illumination. So you're illuminating at a low angle and measuring vertically. So you're watching light scattering, dark field.
So they're actually not migrating at this rate?
No. That's what dark field microscopy is. It's scattering.
What are the dark dots?
We're not sure, but I have been that we were told that somebody added them.
They're not, they're added. They're supposed to be just visually where
But they should have used a Cartesian coordinate.
No, they just put them where they thought the centers of those spirals were, so they're not part of the image. They're part.
This
of the
one is pretty good. This one really worked. Yeah. This movie, I think, was made by Case Weir.
Yes.
Thank you.
So the idea is that the spiral cores aren't moving around.
The cells are not moving, but the signal is.
The spiral cores are not moving around. Right. This is supposed to give you some idea of the density of those spiral cores.
See, this little guy is just going round and round, and it does not appear to be a donut. This is something that Wouter and I looked carefully at. There's no quiescent central region, as far as we can tell, here. But mathematically, that's important.
Yeah, right.
So that was a little magic marker, I think, on the overlaid. Okay? So there's part of the problem. Well, about 25 years ago, Gunter Gerisch happened to notice that when he had the cells in suspension, so now there's no topological inhomogeneity. They're all in solution. They're being bubbled with oxygen to keep them metabolically happy. And they would change their light scattering properties in a population of 10 to the 7th cells. 10 million cells would all give rise to these changes in light scattering. And he was fascinated. And they could measure it with great resolution. It's some of the best data in the whole field, but he had no idea what was going on. But he assumed that it had something to do with cyclic AMP and measured adenyl cyclase, and found that adenyl cyclase activity, the enzymatic activity, changed with about a 7-minute periodicity. And so it's not the amount of the protein, it's whether or not it is active. And it would change about fourfold. And it would do this exactly at the beginning of a change in one of these light scattering periods. And so how could this possibly happen? Now we start getting theoretical. A lot, yes?
So this graph, this very clean graph at the bottom,
this is not the amount, this is the enzymatic activity, how much cyclic AMP it can make per milligram protein, per minute. Specific activity.
Of the whole.
Yeah, you collect, 10 of the 6 cells, you lyse them, and you assay them fast.
Okay.
That's technical stuff. This is a very difficult enzyme to work with. We have to know how to do it. So we're mostly in Peter Devriotti's lab, started to define in molecular terms some of the players. And one of them is the 7 transmembrane G protein coupled receptor, which binds cyclic AMP and responds. The cyclic AMP can come from the outside or can be autogenously produced over here by adenyl cyclase. ACA is adenyl cyclase. When the receptor is ligand bound, a signal transduction pathway is initiated by which G beta gamma, crack, maybe another protein, PIA, come in, and 30 seconds later, and that's a very curious lag, will activate adenyl cyclase so that the activity goes up. It then produces cyclic AMP. Approximately 90% is released into the environment, and 10% stays within the system. Well, this is a positive feedback loop and shows how the cells can respond, but it will clearly just take off and must be regulated to give rise to the periodic oscillations.
There's no protein
protein responsible for shuttling the cyclic AMP across?
It is not known how cyclic AMP goes out. This particular adenyl cyclase is not necessary. It is a transmembrane protein, but you can replace it with a different one, and cyclic AMP will still be released. Gunter Gerish thought for a while that it was like a synapse. There were synaptic vesicles. Nobody's been able to repeat that data, and it's now thought nobody talks about it.
Okay.
It gets out. We really don't know how. It's a charged membrane, so it's not going to just diffuse out. No one has found a mutant. Well, I mean, there are a lot of Ag-minus mutants. See, the way we get most of this is by mutation. And, you know, there were mutations in CAR1. Guess what? They don't respond. Mutations in adenyl cyclase, they don't make cyclic AMP here. They make a little bit from a different enzyme. But no one's really found a mutant that I'm aware of that does not secrete. Has Peter ever looked? It would be an Ag-minus. It would be fascinating. It's a piece of this puzzle that we don't know the molecular basis of.
Does it mean that there are potentially many channels and exporters?
No, I think it means that we haven't assayed, no one out of the 100 different labs has directly assayed for release of cyclic AMP. It would not be an easy one. They would not be able to generate those oscillations. They wouldn't aggregate. And that's easy to recognize. And there are maybe 4 or 5 Ag-minus strains that we've isolated, because we've done a saturation mutagenesis. We've got them all. There are about six of them we understand. There's another 4 or 5 we don't. One of them, and it's a very good possibility, and it'd be fascinating to find it, may be directly involved in release of cyclic AMP. It's actually a really good idea. I don't know anybody, we haven't talked about that before. To really get this process here, looking at the mutants. And there are a bunch.
Can you just look at the genome of transporters?
We certainly could look at the sequence of those mutants. I've scanned them, not with that idea in mind, and don't remember one that had, you know, multiple transmembrane domains. But I could go back and look if I had my computer here. We'll get to that. You mean how long does this take?
Yeah.
Once you add cyclic AMP from the outside, nothing happens to adenyl cyclase for 30 seconds. I find that one of the most interesting, delays. It's the dog not barking, to use the Sherlock Holmes thing, for 30 seconds. Then it turns on. So there may be multiple components in this relay. Moreover, most of the adenyl cyclase is a long way. It's on the other side of the cell. But some of it may be right next door, however.
Couldn't that be that the crack has a pH domain that sends us PIP3 liquids?
It certainly does. And we're going to have a lot of discussion of that in this meeting.
Couldn't just be the production of PIP3 liquids?
No, because crack jumps on within about 2 seconds. So this is PIP3 mediated, and that will be the subject of a lot of the other talks. It's very curious. The crack gets on in 5 seconds. Adenyl cyclase doesn't get activated. And everybody agrees on this numbers game for about 30 seconds.
But it peaks.
And then it peaks at about 3 minutes, adenyl cyclase. But it doesn't even start.
7 minutes?
Yes, the whole oscillation knows it'll go up and down in about 7 minutes. And that was in Gerish's stuff from 1977. This is the time scale here. This is starting up at 10, and here it's starting up at 20. So when you add cyclic AMP from the outside, you know when you added it. You then start assaying the adenyl cyclase every 20, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And at 20 seconds, nothing's happened. At 30 seconds, not much has happened. At 40 seconds, it starts to happen. You extrapolate back the line, and it comes in somewhere around 30 to 40 seconds.
And then there's the 3 minutes. What is that time
scale? Then it will continue to increase the enzyme assay, the activity, for the next 3 minutes, and then it will start to decrease.
But Bill, I think certainly the translocation of cracks and membrane is part of the line. And then I think it
peaks. Carol tells me that it's down there in 1 to 2 seconds.
It starts, but I don't
That's think right.
The majority of it doesn't get there until probably 15 to 20 seconds.
All right, but in where you add cyclic AMP to a population of cells, the crack gets on in about 5 seconds, and by 10 seconds, it's off. Mm. In a whole population of cells? No? How long? 20 seconds?
20.
Okay, has adenyl cyclase started up? No. It's leaving behind some sort of a mark that subsequently, for the next 3 minutes, leads to the activation of adenyl cyclase. So there's a lot of really interesting biochemistry here that none of us who work on this or think about this can explain. But I think it is important when looking at the overall scheme in Dictyostin, because we're going to focus in at one point for what happens in the first second. And then others will focus in on what happens in the first 60 seconds. I'm trying to give an overview at about the 10-minute level. So here's a positive feedback loop that will obviously go off screen. And so it has to be regulated. We found from the saturation mutagenesis screen various other components which are absolutely necessary for normal signaling and response of the cells. And we had no idea that they were involved in this until we got a mutant, which was aberrant, cloned it, sequenced it, and said, aha, it's a MAP kinase. Or in this case here, Reg-A, aha, it is a cyclic AMP phosphodiesterase. We thought we knew about the phosphodiesterase. Well, it turns out that it's a completely different phosphodiesterase, which does the majority of the work in breaking down cyclic AMP inside the cell. When CAP binds to CAR1, the receptor, it not only activates adenyl cyclase, but very rapidly in a separate pathway that is probably mediated by the G-alpha 2 subunit, activates a MAP kinase cascade coming down to this protein kinase, a MAP kinase member. So it's very rapidly activated. We know from genetic and some biochemical evidence that this MAP kinase inhibits the phosphodiesterase. So now we've got a double deal. The accelerator has been hit and the brake has been taken off, has been inhibited. So now you're inhibiting the breakdown of cyclic AMP and stimulating the production. Cyclic AMP will go up a lot. We also know the major mediator of internal cyclic AMP is the cyclic AMP dependent protein kinase, which has a regulatory subunit that normally inhibits the enzyme, which is a protein kinase itself, a different protein kinase than ERK2. When cyclic AMP binds the receptor, it dissociates from the catalytic subunit, and pKa will have its effect. It will control many different things. Transcription, probably via a Krebs member, has recently been recognized. It will control also the activity of ERK2, as was shown by Maneko Maeda and Rick Vertel's lab. pKa directly inhibits ERK2. And now we have various feedbacks. There is also evidence that is less conclusive, but necessary for the modeling, that pKa inhibits this signal transduction process up here at some unspecified point. And that is put into the model in this manner. So now, to simplify it and not confuse you with little bumps to indicate they're real proteins, think of them just as boxes. And here we have CAR1 activating adenyl cyclase and ERK2. ERK2 is inhibiting Reg-A, therefore Reg-A no longer inhibits the activation of pKa. This is the cyclic AMP mediated step. And so we have a spurt in pKa activity. However, that then leads to inhibition of ERK2 and inhibition of this activation of adenyl cyclase. That thing will oscillate. You can write rather simple, straightforward differential equations that have activating and deactivating terms for each of these steps. So this is the ACA, DT, that little gizmo means, you know, change with respect to time. And so you have a coupling constant. That will depend on how much active CAR1 is present on the cell at a given time. It will be inactivated in a first order manner by pKa. And there will be another coupling constant. Likewise, down through all of the seven steps, they can be, you know, numerically solved, and it works. It gives a very robust period. You can change many of these constants. It's really hard to get a longer or a shorter period. I've done it, but it's not easy. The amplitude does change if you change these more than a factor of two. What you're looking at here in the red is the adenyl cyclase activity. In the green, it's the internal cyclic AMP. You notice the lag here. That's what gives the timing to this whole process, is that these things take time. They're enzymatic activities, they're phosphorylations, dephosphorylations, etc. And it will give this very robust 7-minute period, and it just keeps going. This Java presentation is available on my website. Rudolf Appel and a friend of his made it available. This and another one are there in case you want to play with it. I also have a copy here with me in this machine. Yes?
How were these Ks? I didn't quite understand. The Ks determined?
The Ks were determined by Mike Laub by more or less, I'm not quite sure, but I think it was more or less trial and error. We sort of optimized for some and then optimized for others. It wasn't done in a particularly mathematically fancy manner.
Well, I wasn't asking about...
So many of them were constrained by measurements in the changes of cyclic AMP, the changes in MAP kinase activity, the changes in adenyl cyclase activity. I can't remember what else. They were set by biochemically measured parameters. There were some others that we had no direct data on, and they were just optimized to make this thing work. And then we started varying them from the optimum. Yes, it's very important that those components are known from molecular genetic arguments to play essential roles, that the architecture is correct, and that they produce the measured changes in those components which have been measured.
And one might hope that, I mean, as you... as time moves forward, you would further constrain them and test the completeness or the...
I hope I'll convince you for a few of those in the next half hour. Yes, that's the whole name of the game. Yes?
So roughly how many of the 14 or so parameters were mathematically obtained?
I'm not sure I know what you mean by mathematically, but
some of them came from
they were constrained within a certain range such that the measured changes in internal cyclic AMP were generated, such that the measured changes in ERK2, the MAP kinase activity, were constrained, you know, or fit. Adenyl cyclase, pKa is very, very difficult to measure meaningfully in cell lysates, because the dissociation and association of the R and C subunits. It's a bitch to assay real internal pKa activity. Although we did our best. I mean, we took the best data we had and again constrained the changes in pKa activity. So out of the 14, I don't know, I haven't counted it that way, 4 or 5. We're constrained by biochemical experimental data.
But you just said that it's quite robust.
It's robust with respect to period, yes. But getting it to generate meaningful, you know, the observed changes in internal and external cyclic AMP, fitting the data for ERK2, pKa, et cetera, adenyl cyclase, we had... We could find a range of about plus or minus twofold. And you could play with this thing. You can change these constants here and see what the outcome is in, you know, immediately on the website. And I, as I say, I have the little Java program here with me.
So the twofold changes in each one gives you robustness of the 7-minute period or of the amplitudes that are observed?
Both.
Both. But if you just want the robustness of the period, do you know how big the...
It's in the range of plus or minus fivefold for period, for most of them. Where's Pablo? Am I wrong on that one? I mean, you went and analyzed it and found some that were more critical than others.
Yeah, there's two or three parameters that...
that are more critical.
That are more critical, and some you can change.
They hardly matter.
They hardly matter.
Is there any insight that can be gained from those two or three? Well, I don't remember which they are.
I don't remember which ones they are, but my guess is that the ones that are critical, your scheme, you use linear,
yes,
a linear scheme of activation and so on.
Yes.
But you're probably,
that's a great oversimplification. I agree with you.
That's the one where I would try to...
to focus in on and try to make more sophisticated.
Right. Well, but I mean...
Now, we are trying to develop a different way of handling the data that is a kinetic entomological based presentation, but that's not yet completed work.
So that comment says maybe your underlying architecture of differential equations needs to be addressed.
No, I think the architecture is probably correct. That's amazing. The equations are quite simplistic. They're all first order in breakdown, suggesting that the product, the component itself is rate limiting. That may not always be true. We don't know. We don't know what's going on at the millisecond level inside the cell with respect to each molecule. So we make these simplifications. Even the way this whole thing is presented is a simplification to keep it in constant units. And there are grave dangers in that, which we recognize and are working on. But the other way of presenting it in sort of a kinetic manner is work in progress.
Can you relate that to some Newton behavior?
Yes. Well, all right, I'll jump to the mutants. Okay. Here, if you look at cyclic AMP signaling, you have a car 1 null. It doesn't have any signaling whatsoever. An ACA null, none. ERK2, none. Reg A.
By signaling, you mean oscillation?
Yeah, it will not put out cyclic AMP. You want more sophistication. You want me to give you a partial adenyl cyclase mutant that is reduced by 64% and see what happens. I'd love to be able to do that. No. I don't know of any. No, I know what you're saying, that it would be lovely if you had the full molecular genetic spectrum and see whether it fits all of the predictions. That is... It could be done. It's conceivable, but it has not yet been done, partly because nobody's taking these sort of circuits all that seriously.
For example, what happens in the heterozygotes of these various mutants?
Where you could make a twofold change. I have no idea. I seldom work with diploids. The dictyostelium will grow and develop either as a haploid or as a diploid. One could make a heterozygote. And that would be very, that's just a new idea to me. That gives you your twofolds. I'll think about it, because it's quite doable, genetically. Yeah?
So how do you know that you have identified all the players in this? Because there's other players in the secretary that can come.
You never know, at least I don't think you ever know, if you've identified all the players, but these players are sufficient to generate the oscillations that we've been seeing. There are other players, without question. Things like pianissimo does something. Nobody knows what. There are undoubtedly, many other players, such as PI3 kinase, that's going to be discussed in great length, RAS-C, which activates it, cyclic GMP comes into the story. But for this level of analysis, this is sufficient. And I think that's the way I look at modeling. One tries to find out the real biochemically, genetically defined components, which are sufficient. Then you can start adding the bells and whistles. For instance, this thing will not give acceptable adaptation. And for that, one does need to bring in other components. And we and others are working on that. Yes?
Another question about the model. So here we just have kinetic parameters, but there are additional parameters, there are total amounts of this or that enzyme.
Not in this particular way of doing the simulation. Not in this one. They're not limited in the amount. But I'll get to it in just a second, I hope. Things change during development, and that does limit. That puts limits on it, and that makes a huge difference. So we'll get to that. It's partly the way the equations. I don't know, Woodard, can you answer that better?
You don't write mathematically correct equations in a way, right? The way these equations are written right now, they're just measuring activation. Everything's linear, breakdown's linear.
They're assuming you're never limited by the amount of an enzyme.
So there's no implicit assumption that there is a conservation of material.
This is not present in these equations.
So the different forms of cyclic AMP, for instance,
is conservation? No. In this particular case, the total amount of cyclic AMP is constrained. No,
is it?
No, but that's but it's in the paper.
Here you assume that the more and more cyclic, for example, the more and more cyclic AMP you add to the cell, the more and more activation you get of CAR1. Now in reality, there's a finite amount of CAR1 enzymes on the cell membrane. And so at some point you've saturated completely how much excitation you have, and you adding more cyclic AMP has no extra effect. This is all assuming that you're never near those saturations.
But I will give the answer in just a minute.
What you're asking for? No. Why is that a good assumption? Or I mean, it probably isn't. But
you know, when you write down the equations, typically like amounts of enzymes, total amounts.
Right. Should be conserved.
Right.
Okay, and we will get to that. Okay, wait a minute. All right, now I will get to it. I hope, and I'll ask you whether it satisfies you, because these things change during development. And we simulated that. Yes? It depends how you define excitable, is what it comes down to. I mean, is there a threshold? Is that what you're thinking of excitability? It's not clear that dictyostelium has a threshold. It's a linear response.
In the sense that each cell would not be oscillating, just it would emit some pulse if it receives.
You could have a single burst response rather easily if by affecting the ratio of external phosphodiesterase to adenyl cyclase activity. In other words, the minute the cyclic AMP gets out, it gets destroyed. That will lead to a single pulse response, and you can see that easily.
So let me answer this question.
This is a very physics-y problem we've had trouble with.
So in the actual cells, in testing, there is a regime in which it's self-oscillating. Okay. That's what this was. Attempt at a model for the self-oscillation regime.
Right.
So it's an oscillation. Okay. Now, if you played it out on the surface, then what it always appeared to most of the people who tried to model the waves and the dynamical system was that there is a period of time before this. Right. This is the oscillations are sort of 8 hours to 10 hours in test tubes, whatever. There's a period of time before this
when the system looked excitable, which technically, and you know, technically means that you can propagate waves through it, but that left to its own device, the cell would not just start oscillating. So you need there to be some sources, or you need there to be some spiral wave or something which organizes this excitable activity. So this model does not yet account for that possibility. This model accounts for why the positive feedback and the negative feedback, as you saw, that give rise to the self-oscillatory behavior, but is in my opinion at least, has two linear excitation pathway to account for the excitation of the system. Here, if the way the system gets excited is all sort of by linear amplification. And so, to the extent that my current belief is that that's okay in the self-oscillatory region as a character of what's going on, but to go and explain excitable behavior, if one believes it exists, one would need a much more sophisticated way of understanding the way in which the excitation works, which here is being put in a very, very simple way. A sort of just put in cyclic AMP and it exponentially produces more cyclic AMP in a linear manner. And exactly what that nonlinearity is, exactly how long it takes, is a very hard question that in this system which still needs work.
I can't find one in the literature, but I know that I could do that on paper in the computer. All I have to do is increase the external phosphodiesterase, which is a free variable. No, I don't think they actually ever do that, give you a single pulse response. I don't think they're excitatory even. Moreover, if I really do the experiment, I go and I buy beef heart phosphodiesterase. You can add it to the cells. It'll stop them signaling each other. It works. I mean, yeah. We're still debating that, shall we say, Herbie and Ruder and I. And seeing if we could generate true classical excitability or not, and whether or not that's important. This whole sort of project I got into was done with Mike Laub, who was an undergraduate at that time, and I thought it was a lot of fun, he thought it was a lot of fun. It was only when I saw this result of his that I said, my God, I think this thing's real. Because it responds to exogenous cyclic AMP, which you can put into the computer, by a phase shift with almost exactly the same structure as what Günter Gerlich and others published 25 years earlier in real observation of phase shift. If you add cyclic AMP in the first half of the wave, it delays the whole period, then there's an abrupt change, and if you add it later, it will now advance the phase. This is exactly what the computer says. In fact, if there's any difference here, I would bet the computer answer is closer to the truth. Any system in which you have a phase shift response, Art Winfrey has pointed out, will result in entrainment of multiple independent units, and you can do this in the computer by having two different colors for two different cells that are coupled via the environment. So they're responding to each other's cyclic AMP, and they will go through various little oscillations such that after about 10 periods, they are perfectly synchronized. This accounts for the fact that of what Günter Gerlich observed a long time ago, that you can have millions of cells all changing their light scattering synchronously, all having their adenyl cyclase activated synchronously. Out here, these two, which were maximally offset at the beginning, are now completely in phase. And that led me to say this model has a chance of actually capturing what the cells do and is worth discussing. And so here we are 5 years later still discussing it. Gunter-Garrish also noticed that initially, for the first 4 hours of development, the cells didn't respond very much. That's because they don't have CAR1. They don't have adenyl cyclase. Then they get into an oscillatory regime. The second part of that, they will start moving, and then it stops. And that's interesting. And I hadn't fully appreciated this back in 1979. I wasn't working on this sort of thing. And I said, gee, can we simulate that with this same architecture and way of presenting the activities? And we changed the activity of adenyl cyclase as it does in development. Namely, it starts off at just about zero and then accumulates to our peak at about 8 hours. Then we also changed the activity of the cyclic AMP phosphodiesterase in the way it works in the cell, which is that there is an enzymatic mechanism for breaking it down. It's a CALA, FBOX, the two different genes involved in ubiquination, and then it goes to the pericytome and is broken down. And if either of those components are mutated, then it will continue to oscillate for longer. And we ran the simulation with those changes. So we're now ramping adenyl cyclase between 1 hours and between 1 unit and 6 units over the first 4 hours. And it's going up, and then it starts oscillating spontaneously. We're not doing anything to it. And we're ramping Reg A down from 3, which is normally what it was staying at, to 0.5, such that it reaches 0.5 at 8 hours, and that turns it off. And this, to me, looks exactly like what Gunter-Garrish had previously published. So here, under these conditions, we are changing the total amount of the enzymatic activity to fit what is observed. Now, actually, CAR1, which is the last one down here, changes between, in this case, we said 1 to 5. If you ramp it, it doesn't change. So you can ramp both CAR1 and adenyl cyclase, it gives this. Or you just ramp CAR1. They are both limiting components. And you could play around with all of these things and the kinetic constants. Again, it's on my website, and I think I have it here in the computer if anybody would like to explore the, you know, kinetic constant space, whatever one.
So it is, it promised the answer to my question came in the second column.
That's what I thought.
Right.
Okay. So, moreover, you can do the experiment yourself just by pushing buttons. Okay. So now we're finally up to this one, which we've already seen.
Can you confirm any of this predicted number by experimental measurements?
Well,
I know there's a long number of predictions.
I think the simple answer is no, because they're very difficult experiments. When you're talking about phosphorylation, dephosphorylation of given proteins, the assays are very cumbersome, very non-quantitative, and we haven't worried about spatial inhomogeneities within a cell, which play enormous roles, as we will be discussing throughout the next few days. I wish I could say something more satisfying, but not really directly. In other words, is this number really 0.9 or is it 15? Even the units are unusual for this. In the new, if it works, kinetic enzymological presentation of the circuit, the numbers that we'll be inputting are much more directly related to enzymatic activity as normally assayed, substrate affinity as normally assayed. These are rather unusual ones, and so we haven't focused on them. Yeah?
I'm confused by something very simple. When you say ACA is linearly increasing from 1 to 6,
so that it reaches
after 3 point something, it started oscillating. So
right.
What did you do? Had
nothing.
I don't understand why you say from 1 to 6.
How could it
doesn't get to 6.
It will. It's getting up here. When it's fully activated, it's 6.
But you're not doing it.
No, I'm allowing it to get up to 6 by 4 hours.
But you are
4 hours.
Increase. This is just a question of language.
Yes.
By hand, you're doing this other increase.
No. Well, we just set these parameters and let the machine run.
But how did you set that for linear increase?
It's sort of like making the parameter a function of time. Yeah. So it's like a dynamic bifurcation, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
but if you
normally
program the parameters...
Okay, one of the parameters, but not the density, the activities. The activities are... I have a very elementary...
What term in the equation are you varying by is a function of
time,
right?
That's
fundamentally the question, right?
Yeah, I think so. And hope I can answer it. Wouldn't. What did we do?
No, I can't. I can't answer because we didn't do it.
Yes, you?
Yeah, great function.
This was Sam Payne.
Oh, this was Sam. I did know it. It was done last summer. And
that's the whole thing. I thought it was
ACA. Well, the reason you thought that is because that's what he said. But he didn't mean
it. So I think it says ACA activity. But are you talking ACA or ACA?
Ends up
ACA and ACA activity.
This is activity being plotted.
That's K1 being plotted.
No, this is the output.
Output of the ACA.
Right. The specific activity. Okay.
But you're varying. You have to be varying the parameters in the equation. There's no other thing you could vary.
Exactly.
This one
right.
Is K1.
So you're varying either K1 or K2. I think probably the ratio.
It was actually the total amount of ACA.
It's not the same set of equations.
It is the same set.
Okay. I think we'll have to just clarify.
Okay.
Fine.
I will think more about it. Okay. Hey, I had a whole another spiel. This is when it gets really interesting. This was just the introduction. This is when it's published. Everybody, not that publishing means it's right. Hey, there's a really interesting thing here that we found really to our surprise, which is that the same mutants that screwed up cyclic AMP signaling also affected directional sensing. That's a really different property. That's part of the response. Nothing to do with whether they're relaying the cyclic AMP. It's how they're moving. And, you know, wild type, by definition, is excellent. And it really is. And all of these are affected. As you'll see, the reason they're affected is that the cells are no longer able to put out a single anterior pseudopode. An amoeba, unlike us, who are constrained by being bipedal, are, you know, one of these kind of things. They can go any which way they want it. So if they're going to go productively in one direction, they have to constrain the lateral pseudopodes. So the basal lateral surfaces have to not make pseudopodes. Then they can move in a given direction. And you just have to think about an amoeba as an amoeba. And the data for this is do time-lapse microscopy and then analyze the films, and you can plot the centroid. Here's a wild type that's going that way pretty well. That's how accurate Dicti is. That's the way it evolved. You also can plot the instantaneous velocity. These are experiments carried out with Deb Wessels and David Saul, who are colleagues at Iowa, and it's very nice periodicity somewhere in there of about 8 minutes, I think. You look at the cyclic AMP phosphodiesterase mutant. No. Reg A. It's got miserable periodicity, if any, and it doesn't know where to go.
How's the sequence?
What you're doing is following one cell in a field of about 1,000 cells, which have developed for 4 or 5 hours.
It's so
it's a field. That's right. So it could be signaling or it could be a response.
There's nothing external to cyclic AMP.
Now watch. That says Reg A screwed up. We didn't know that before. Because you have to have low cell density and they didn't know where to go. So it was either signaling or response or both. If you put a wild type cell with 10 mutant cells around it, you can find out if the signaling is okay, because you know the wild type can respond. It doesn't know where to go. Signaling is screwed up. You do the converse experiment. You put one Reg A cell and 10 wild type cells. Actually, you put 1,000 Reg A cells and 10,000 wild type cells, so that the 10,000 you know are making nice signals and relaying it, and the Reg A doesn't know where to go. It's following the Reg A cell. So both signaling and response are affected by the loss of that phosphodiesterase. And the reason is, can be seen here, if you draw the outlines of a cell in a stable, imposed external gradient, a Zygmund chamber, wild type looks like this. There are little bumps on the side, but it's going that way. You look at a Reg A mutant, and it's got lots of lateral pseudopodes. No wonder it has a problem responding. And it's going that way, but not as efficiently. And if you want to get molecular about it, what you see in the front of a wave, a temporal wave, for wild type is that most of the myosin heavy chain 2 becomes cortically localized except where there's a pseudopode. That's a pseudopode. Don't worry, we have the phase pictures. In a Reg A mutant, you do not get the formation of a cortex which can generate rigor and limit lateral pseudopodes.
What is this imaging?
This is the amount of fluorescently labeled antibody specific to myosin heavy chain 2, where the vertical axis is an indication of the intensity, and the two-dimensional thing is the position relative to the cell. The cell is like that. These walls are how much of the fluorescence is found at that position.
So which is the front of the cell, right?
This is putting a pseudopode out. It really is. This is the, it's making a new dominant pseudopode here.
So there's more myosin when you make the pseudopode.
No, that's thinner. That's less intense. To my eye,
it's darker there.
It's not quite as bright and shiny.
But it's higher.
But the height.
That has to do with how you angle it. No, there is less there.
So it's
the color of the.
Okay, it's the color. Moreover, it depends what angle you're looking at this thing at. Believe me, there's less myosin. But let's not make a big deal about it. The point is the mutant doesn't do it. Hey, this is what's different. Let's not get too, you know. Moreover, I am not really trying to explain, and I don't think anybody can, all of the molecular interactions that are involved in making a pseudopode, let alone the dominant pseudopode. That is a challenge for the near future that we're all eager to get into, but I don't think we can do it yet.
So the Reg A myosin cells don't polarize as well ever?
No, they really don't. They stay this way all the way throughout the cycle. No matter what you do to them, they don't form a myosin-heavy cortex.
Just remind us what all Reg A is doing is regulating
cyclic AMP. That's right. Which controls PKA. PKA controls the phosphorylation of the myosin light chain regulatory subunit, which controls whether or not it will form a complex.
You didn't tell us that.
I just did. I didn't know that everybody really wanted all that nitty-gritty biochemical pathway. We have good evidence that that's what's going on from looking at mutants, rather sophisticated site-directed mutants, in the regulatory light chain of myosin.
I didn't realize the cyclic AMP led to the myosin.
Yes. Moreover, point, you look here at a different way of generating changes in PKA activity. Here, we just knocked out the regulatory subunit. So there's no regulatory subunit. So the catalytic subunit's active all the time. They don't know where to go. Their chemotaxis is also screwed up for pretty much the same reasons. When we knocked out the phosphodiesterase, cyclic AMP got high and stayed high because the enzyme that breaks it down was inactivated. Lots of PKA. If we knock out the regulatory subunit, lots of PKA. Same phenotype. And it is also the same in that you get lots of lateral pseudopodes in a PKA mutant. Believe me, that's a null mutant. I know it. Danny Fuller in my lab made it. This is wild type. It's going along. This is in a stable exogenous gradient.
Okay.
Yes, Alex.
What is the scale here? I'm just curious.
What is what?
Scale.
Here?
How long will it be?
10 minutes. Zero.
In space.
Oh, how big is it? 5 microns, about.
The whole travel is 5 microns.
Yeah, here this, no, this thing would probably be 50 microns.
50 microns. So the heat is 5 microns, the heat of the cell.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about 5 microns there.
I mean, the last image you see there, which there's nothing, that's the side of the cell.
This is a cell here. The openness is the last surround.
Maybe 100 or 150 microns. Oh, yeah,
200.
That's pretty impressive.
Okay, less than 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused about a couple issues. I don't know if this is a good point or if you will get to it later. So on one hand, you have this oscillations and the machinery for that. I think it was just pretty clear how it works. At least you have good components that can model the whole process. On the other hand, we have the chemotaxis and they're somehow related.
Yes.
But there are cells that don't have these oscillations and the chemotax, you know, like some higher eukaryotes. So the question is in some way...
you just opened a whole bag of worms, okay.
Okay, so the bag of worms is, do you think these oscillations are an inherent part of chemotaxis? Or is chemotaxis and this oscillatory behavior really two distinct mechanisms, and in some way it's confusing to mix them together? This is my question.
Dictyostelium is not confused. It didn't go extinct. And they are coupled, as I hope I've convinced you here. I've talked to Mooming Poo.
Because they use similar enzymes and it's kind of an accidental.
They're both coupled to pKa, is what it comes down to. And pKa is part of the oscillatory machine and therefore oscillates. Even in the absence of a cyclic AMP gradient, movement is oscillatory in dictyostelium. I've asked Mooming Poo, who studies growth cone movement and chemotaxis a lot, whether or not he's seen oscillations. He said yes. Has he published them? No, because he had not yet understood whether or not they played a significant role in chemotaxis of a growth cone of neurons. I would like those who study neutrophils to tell me if they have observed oscillatory behavior, and if not, whether or not they will go back and look for it. Because you don't see it until you start looking. You have to have the question posed to you. So I don't know if a neutrophil responds in an oscillatory, in a periodic manner, but I would predict that it would. Because I believe in universality.
There's some other oscillators in some cells, like there's calcium oscillators, and they have different reasons to exist, possibly like in cells that have growth cones.
Yes.
In some cases have calcium oscillators.
Yes.
But may or may not be related to the chemotactic.
Well, you have to ask the question.
The signaling in many ways is bistable and oscillatory.
Yes. There are great advantages to being in kinetic equilibrium. It's much more stable to have an oscillatory thing than to be
but
a linear.
Maybe I should just say, but you think there's a mandatory link between an inherent capability of a cell to oscillate and chemotaxis. So in your system,
yes.
They stop oscillating, they stop chemotaxin.
Well, they do it much less effectively.
7-8 hours, later in development. Take these cells.
They are still chemotactic, but they are not very good. They're like this. They de-differentiate and get back into the chemotactic mode. And they will then start oscillating again also. So I do hope that the mammalian chemotaxis and general response scholars consider whether or not there's an underlying oscillator, because I think there might be.
Yeah, what happens if you use a different chemotaxis? Because they are folic acid and other things like lithium or magnesium calcium, where they actually show people.
I haven't analyzed it. There is quite a lot of data in the literature about folate chemotaxis. It is real. I mean, I've done it.
But interesting to see when these guys.
Correct. I don't know. The biochemistry of folate response is not anywhere near as well understood as that for cyclic AMP.
Yeah,
We don't know what the receptor is, or there may be two. We don't know how it's linked to, and I don't think there's any evidence, it's not relayed.
You would say there's another oscillator.
It's not relayed.
You would say there would be another oscillator?
No, I'd say there wouldn't be, because among other things, it's not amplified and relayed.
I would predict you wouldn't see a difference if you did both.
You think it would be the same?
Yeah.
Well, at what stage of development? They're hardly responsive to folate at 6 hours.
I think that's a key component, though, is that the mutants are not polarized. I think that plays a...
But they still won't be 12 hours later. This doesn't change. I mean, we have looked throughout development.
Could you just remind us, when you say it oscillates, does it mute? You mean the movement is jerky?
Yeah.
Even in a nice, clean, cyclic M-phase gradient.
Yeah. Let's try this. Here's your 6-minute period.
Oh, but
that's instantaneous velocity.
That's an aggregation center.
That's an aggregation center.
I want you to put it in artificial gradient of cyclic AMP. And then I'll bet it doesn't oscillate.
It does move in a periodic manner.
Even then?
And I haven't got the slide showing it. Yes. Well, and particularly I trust David Saul.
Sure. So even in a stable gradient, they oscillate.
I'm pretty doggone sure of that, but I'm not absolutely, Lewis.
Okay.
Isn't
important?
Yes, it is. And we'll talk to David.
The big step that occurred when shifting from oscillations to motility, the cells are getting polarized. So you cycle KMP, setting up a gradient internally.
There's no evidence for, but there's been no measurement, really. It's very hard to measure internal cyclic AMP in a meaningful manner, where you can distinguish anterior from posterior, etc. So there's really no data on that. There are various components that do become polarized, such as adenyl cyclase itself. It gets localized to the posterior in a rather stable manner. And other things that we don't know about become stable because the front will stay the front after about 6 hours of pulsing.
So it actually gets localized, or its activation is a...
Now, it itself, because you're coupling it to a dye, GFP, which you can see, and it's always found localized in one place, which will be the back. That's a very recent paper by Carol Perron. Trying to not take up the whole morning, let me go through a little bit what wild-type cells do, because it does have bearing on what those mutants do also. In the front of a wave, when the wave of cyclic AMP first is passing over a cell, you will get a single anterior pseudopod, and it's down on the surface. Here, you've changed the rotation. This is the same cell as that. It's just looked at from a more oblique angle. I think that's the way to put it. I'm not sure. You're looking down on it differently. So this thing here, it's almost like, you know, lamina podia. That's the same as this thing here. So in the first 20 seconds, you get a dominant anterior pseudopod, and it's down on the surface, and the cell is moving that away. A couple of minutes later, at the peak of the wave, the pseudopod is retracted. It's pulled back in and up, and the whole cell becomes ovoid. This is just what's observed. So again, these are fairly fancy computer-assisted 3D reconstruction of Z-sections of cells in a temporal gradient. In the back of the wave, the cells put out lots of lateral pseudopods. And that explains why they don't go backwards and remove all of their directionality, because now the concentration of cyclic AMP is higher behind them. Let me go through that a little bit in a schema. Here's the front of a wave coming from a group of cells over here. So it's diffusing outward. And here's a little cell. It will encounter cyclic AMP at the front first, but it takes only about a second before this whole cyclic AMP is above threshold throughout the cell. So it experiences a spatial as well as a temporal gradient. And that will become very important for some analyses of how directionality is established that Wouda will talk about tomorrow. So direction is established in the first second or two that a cell has responded to cyclic AMP. At the peak of the wave, as this thing continues to diffuse over it, then the cortical layer of actin myosin is dismantled. You can see it coming off that cortex, doing the same thing. In other words, you now fix the cell at this stage here in a temporal wave, stain it with antibodies, look at it. The cortex has been dismantled. And we think we know why, that that's PKA mediated. We know some of that pathway. Then at the back of the wave, this has continued to diffuse across. And they had stimulated cells distally to secrete cyclic AMP. Yeah. So it's actually higher behind them. They want to go this way. They don't go anywhere. They just dither around. And that's what you observe. So that explains how they can respond to a propagating wave by directionality. And that was not obvious 20 years ago. A lot of people worried about that problem. I'll give you my point of view on what is happening at the various chemotactic stages, but this will be the subject of discussion from many different people for the next few days. This is certainly controversial, etc., and there are lots and lots of details that are very, very important. Okay, in the first second, cyclic AMP reaches threshold at the anterior before the posterior. The pH domain protein, such as CRAC gene, I named for the sense of fun, PhD, I gave it a PhD, because all it has is a pH domain. It's a dumb little protein, but it is absolutely essential for chemotaxis. It came out of the saturation screen. It gets localized, so does AKT, or sometimes called PKB, and other such things at the anterior. At the posterior, you don't find them, and there is evidence that cyclic GMP may mediate the inhibition in the basolateral portions of the cell of PI3 kinase. All of the data is consistent with that, but it certainly is not sufficient to prove that the target of cyclic GMP is PI3 kinase, although we have a plausible scheme how it might be.
But hold on a second, how does that signal transferred from the front to the back?
By diffusion. And that's what Wouter is going to discuss, when is it, tomorrow afternoon? In wonderful upside down deltas detail, you know, diffusion constants. I always forget the name of that thing. What is it?
Upside down deltas upset me too.
One of those things. That I was working through in a sophisticated manner, whether or not this is a plausible scheme, and the answer is yes. So in the front of the wave, for those 3 minutes, it moves, and it only moves, and that's what's observed. The cells only move for 2 or 3 minutes, then they stop. And again, that escaped Guntagerish and lots of other people to realize how important that is. So they do produce an anterior pseudopode. There is actin assembly. Organelles are...
Can you tell us how that is pushed out?
Oh, I wish I could.
I'm delighted to hear that it hasn't been solved.
Yes, we have many more theoretical biophysics meetings to before we can understand how, for instance, the dendritic arbor of actin is pushing the anterior membrane, if that is how it works, whether or not it's, you know, a Brownian ratchet, whether or not it is, you know, all those things that are under a lot of discussion in dire need of facts. But the observations are that this is an organelle-free domain with a high proportion of actin. Myosin II is not found in the anterior. It's mostly in the basal lateral. It is involved in the establishment of cortical rigor, limitation of lateral pseudopodes, and the retraction of the posterior, because you've got to pull the butt up to get it to move forward. It has occurred to me that this this region of the cortex may actually extend underneath the anterior pseudopodes. So the anterior pseudopodes are almost outside of that portion of the cell which is surrounded by a cortex. Now, there's no really good microscopic data supporting that or other direct measurements. It is a way, it seems to me, that one could start to at least to simulate. If you think of this as a bag within the cortex and this as an external separate bag on the front. Part of the problem with simulating such complicated procedures and processes is there are too many degrees of freedom, too many components, and the field has not moved significantly, in my opinion, in the last 5-10 years of sort of how do you make a pseudopod? And then let alone the problem of adhesion, which is also important. So that will be a lot of discussion on actual movement. But then why they don't go back and retrace themselves is explained because this cortex is dismantled and you do get lateral pseudopodes. So it works. And I'm suggesting that it is important in this and perhaps in other systems that signal each other and move, that they are both coupled to an underlying oscillator. And that my guess is that once such an oscillator evolved that works as well as this one does, it was conserved in many other multicellular eukaryotic systems. Lewis Wolpert and I have discussed whether or not Dictyostelium could have evolved into mammals. It clearly didn't because it's Dictyostelium, but it had a ancestor that is also our ancestor, and my guess is it wasn't much before, you know, that this thing had evolved in the common ancestor of Dictyostelium and mammals. It seems to me a likely possibility. Therefore, I recommend other people look for such components in signaling and response. Yeah?
Well, has anybody done that experiment to try to give it either parts of cyclic AMP from the back and see if they can basically go back?
There are several people here, two of them right there, who are trying very hard to do that with very fine timing.
Yeah, so basically just...
Yes. And I gather you're in a lab that's trying to do that as well. It is the pertinent experiment to test these things. There are a lot of predictions about how much lag is allowable to still have directionality and how much not. And nobody's measured it yet because it's not technically that easy, as I think you probably know better than I do. However, I'm thrilled that finally it's getting to be both spatially and quantitatively well defined. There's good resolution. At least people are aiming for that and they realize how incredibly pertinent it is to many of these questions, and that it's a lot easier to work with Dictyostelium than with a growth cone. And for those who don't know it, growth cones will chemotax, but it takes hours. With Dictyostelium, you've got your results in minutes. And there's a very big technical difference.
How steep are the cyclic AMP gradients that one would have to apply? What is the, when you showed these waves, how many cell diameters, or what is the percentage from the front to the back that they can...
It has been calculated that in stable gradients, once the cells have determined directionality, they can maintain directionality with only a 5% difference between the front and the back. And that's really amazing and will be a subject of further discussion.
But these pulses, do they actually happen steeper than that? When these waves pass through the thing, right? You have this periodic...
Well, you have both a temporal and a spatial. We feel that's very important. But the spatial gradient is in the order of 10% higher at the front than at the back. It's very small. And whether that, I mean, it certainly has to be amplified to maintain directionality, because they will maintain a direction for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. They'll keep going up the gradient, as you saw from some of the outline pictures, just showing you the profiles of the cells.
So they're not oscillating
then? They're moving in a periodic manner, but they're keeping their direction.
But I thought they lose the...
This is in a
direction of 7 minutes.
I mean, a stable, externally applied gradient of a certain concentration.
But then they're not oscillating?
No, I'm pretty doggone sure they move in a periodic manner. But I haven't got the data, and I want to check with the guy who's got the data, David Saul.
It seems there's a difference between the oscillation in terms of the cyclic level and also oscillation of the movement. Your cyclic AMP level oscillates at 7 minute interval.
Yes.
And your movement 2 minutes.
No.
You said there's two.
Well, they'll only move for 2 minutes, but the period, from period to period, like here it's 6.3 plus or minus one. This is the instantaneous velocity, movement of the centroid. It goes fast, it goes slow, goes fast, it goes slow, goes fast, goes slow. And the average periodicity here is 6 minutes. Here, I don't know how you get periodicity out of that kind of data.
So you did all this in the population of cell in the like Zeeman chamber.
What yes.
If you isolate, just look at one cell.
That's what they're doing here. Well, this is not a Zeeman chamber. I agree. No, that's the experiment that I'm sure has been done. I am pretty sure that David Saul has told me that it is periodic, the instantaneous velocity change. But I can't absolutely recall the data so that I can say it with confidence to you. And it is a very interesting and pertinent question. Believe it or not, I think I'm done.
Very nice.
The people who did this were two undergraduates in my lab, Mike Laub, who's now a junior fellow at Harvard, and Sam Payne, who's now a graduate student in the bioinformatics department at UCSD. Wouter Rappel, who's here, Gary Shaulsky, Adam Kusper, Maneko Maeda, and Rick Vertel, all worked with me on the phenotypic analysis of the mutants. They're, you know, both the ERK2 and Reg-A and adenyl cyclase. And David Saul and Deb Wessels did most of the measurements, the time-lapse cinematography, under very well-controlled conditions of external cyclic AMP. And Jeff Siegel is a collaborator at the Albert Einstein on the characterization of the MAP kinase. Okay, I'm only half an hour over.
We started 15 minutes late, so you're only 15 minutes over. So.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to time for a couple of questions, and then because we still have one more talk.
Don't you have the data from
Whoops, you want to see that again?
What they were asking about in the Zeeman chamber, whether
they're but it's hard to tell from that
one. It looks like it's not from that data, right?
I thought there was some paper, even in Neutrophils, that said that oscillation, well, you can ask this question even without a gradient. You can just ask about random motion, and you can say, what does the motion look like? Does it look like a constant motion in some direction that changes, or does it look like a sort of, you know, moving and then picking a new direction and moving and picking
this?
A new direction?
Huh?
I thought the evidence was that it moved in a periodic manner, even in neutral.
But what we think that's probably because it's an adaptation.
But that has to do something. It's like movement of a caterpillar.
Right, yeah.
That's the nature of the movement.
Right. I agree with that.
What is the time scale of adaptation?
You can't tell. Well, you have to do centroid analysis. You really have to do centroid analysis.
Anyway, are there any other quick questions? So the issue of what is oscillating, and is oscillation just a result of the mechanical way in which amoeba move, which is this, you know, just moves and then it pulls and then it moves and pulls, or whether there's some inherent cycle of constructing and then deconstructing parts of the cytoskeleton, and whether that's somehow tied to oscillations. I think that's something which we
need, which we can discuss among ourselves.
Yeah. I think the fundamental difference is that the amoeba are having a chemotract that's secreted.
Yes, right.
And feeding back. So it might also be secreted in some other immune cells. I'm not saying this is not happening, but I think in general the idea is that in mammalian chemotaxis that the secretion of the chemotractin is not playing a role in the chemotactic response. So I think this is a fundamental difference in having an autocatalytic feedback as part of the chemotactic response. And I think one has to distinguish that, unless we miss something in mammalian cells. That
David Saul has seen a relay of the signal of neutrophils, I believe, that go to a wound. And he has some not yet definitive data that there must be something being relayed. He gives them that peptide. I don't know this field much. And it is not the peptide that's being relayed. It's something else. But it is action at such a distance that he thinks it is only consistent with some sort of a relay system. I think people haven't looked for it, is the way I see the situation. As I say, I don't work with mammalian cells and don't know the field that well. Do you know people who have looked and direct whether there's a relay system or not, whether there are oscillations or not?
There is oscillation, like calcium oscillation intracellularly. I don't know.
Are we talking in the same time scale? Minutes? Not milliseconds.
That's yes.
Calcium oscillation
per chemotactic cycle.
Okay.
That's the resemblance, yes.
In chemotactic cycle?
In neutrophils, yes.
All right, then you're saying it's periodic.
But there's no evidence yet that the calcium oscillations correlate with some kind of a movement. I've not seen any data on that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a biologist, but I'll